we present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello, and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from the Sun newspaper, read by Diana Speed.
A deputy head and science teacher have resigned after being caught having sex. Word of their sexual encounter at the school awarded an overall rating of good by Ofsted.
Our thanks to Matt Moore for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Andy Hamilton and Hugo Rifkin. And opposite them, on my left, Mark Steele and Susie Ruffle. Andy, whose bromance is looking a little flaky?
Well, hats off to President Macron this week, because, you know, countless world leaders have been perplexed and paralysed even by the problem of exactly how you engage with a man like Donald Trump. And Macron has opted for the extremely bold strategy of initiating a homosexual relationship. No, be fair. No one else thought of that, did they? And it was rather joyous, wasn't it? I mean, they could not keep their hands off each other. They were hugging and holding hands and grooming and kissing. And that's just the stuff that was in front of the cameras. You know, that's just the stuff we saw. I mean, goodness knows what went on behind closed doors in Trump's Oval Office. And that's not a euphemism, so... But I'm not sure that Macron really achieved anything as regards global warming or Iran, because Trump is supposed to renew the Iran deal on the 12th of May, but what he said was, nobody knows what I'm going to do on the 12th of May. And that includes him, I imagine. The other disturbing trend was apparently the Foreign Office, our Foreign Office, is very alarmed that Macron may have usurped Britain's place as Trump's special friend. And I think now is the time when we are going to find out just exactly how much of a patriot Boris Johnson really is.
That's something I learned at the Bullingdon Club.
How do you feel about this, Hugo?
Macron's sort of being quite clever, because after all the hugging and touching and the kissing, he then, you know, he went before Congress and he basically just slagged them off over the Paris Accord and climate change, ripping up the Iran deal, which he said was insane.
Said he was a bad kisser.
And you realise that all along his plan was basically to be nice to Trump's face and then to slag him off using a language he didn't understand. And you thought that was going to have to be French, but it turned out English did just as well.
See Trump showing him around. There was like this amazing video of him showing him like the lawn, and then he went into the Oval Office and he was, you know, when you go around your friend's house and they've got children and their children really bore you by showing you like their little shop, and you have to go, oh yeah, look at your shop, yeah, look, you're a shopkeeper, aren't you? Basically Macron had to do that in the Oval Office, and at one point Donald Trump pointed at his phone and went, that's where I make all my big calls. It's like, well, you're very big, aren't you? You're a very clever boy.
Macron at one point said, we've got a lot in common, you and I, because we're both dissidents from outside the system. See that? This is what they're all now, everyone, against the elite, this thing they all say, Golden Talbot, we're against the elite, Macron is an investment banker, Farage was against the elite, Dulwich College, all of them, the Queen, this some point this year.
Philip and I are sick of the elite.
Yeah. It can work, though. I don't see why it can't work, you know, president or someone who's leader of a European country sycophantically grovelling to an American president. Not been tried before, has it?
Trump is such a full-on entertaining moron that we don't talk much about Macron, but there's quite a strong delusional sort of poor man's Napoleon thing going on there, isn't there?
He's got this whole Jupiterian idea that a president should be like Jupiter, should be aloof. Like, he won't talk to journalists because he thinks they won't understand, and that's actually not that unreasonable, I suppose.
Yeah, and he also uses the word destiny quite a lot. That always worries me. That's not a good sign.
But he's been impressive, I suppose. He's gone over there and he's been charming and he's put up with the nonsense, you know, like the sort of status games, like Trump picking dandruff off his collar as if Trump's got sort of greater scalp integrity than him.
can you imagine if after he'd done that, Macron had reached out to pick a stray hair off Trump's shoulder and pulled it and just all the rest of it had just gone.
Yards and yards of it.
Slowly unravelled him. Yeah. Just totally woolen president. This is the state visit of French President Emmanuel Macron to the White House, where he continued to enjoy what many have described as a bromance with Donald Trump. During the visit, Trump and Macron planted a tree together on the White House front lawn. Things did get a little awkward when the shovel they were using hit a tunnelling Melania, causing her to shout, "Am I past the fence yet?" There was a 21-gun salute at the White House, which, as always, makes you wonder, when are these guys going to learn where to aim? Macron and his wife Brigitte were honoured at a state dinner where the menu tried to marry both cultures. Personally, I love doing that. I once offered Marion Cotillard a 99 with a frog's leg instead of a flake, and she absolutely loved it. I, on the other hand, had a calippo with garlic on it. Not nice. Presidents Trump and Macron intended to honour the shared history between their two nations, which essentially boils down to them both ruining Vietnam and a mutual preference for thin chips. Trump appeared to assert his dominance over Macron by picking dandruff off his suit. The French have different attitudes to power plays. If a Frenchman wants to assert his dominance, he will sleep with your wife, whereas if he wants to appear submissive, he will sleep with your wife. Macron is now widely believed to be the European leader Donald Trump is closest to in what is yet another blow to the battered international prestige of Welsh First Minister Carwyn Jones. 2 points to Andy. Hugo, where is there a row he brewing?
Nice. So this would be Jeremy Corbyn and other senior Labour figures this week met with Jewish groups to see if they could solve the kind of ongoing fuss about Labour supposedly being soft on anti-Semitism from supporters and from other members of the party. And you could tell this just wasn't going to work. And it couldn't have gone more wrong if he'd basically sat them down and said, "I'm delighted to be here. Who wants a pork scratching?" And it did go wrong, because almost immediately afterwards the Jewish groups left saying it had all been pointless and so on. And the main reason it didn't work is because Corbyn and others in his inner circle, they find it really hard to comprehend that there really is a problem here. For a long time, Corbyn couldn't even mention anti-Semitism without saying, "and other forms of racism," right afterwards, to the extent that when people said to him, "you know, your party has a problem with anti-Semitism," he'd say, "and other forms of racism," and they'd say, "oh, no, whoops." But lots of Labour people do get very sort of upset and defensive talking about this, because they look at the Tories and they say, look at Windrush, and say, how come people are only talking about our racism? Look at them, look at Boris Johnson, and look at the bloke who dressed as a Nazi. And you've got to understand this, that the Tories are supposed to be so bigoted that lots of people don't want to vote for them. Whereas you're Jeremy Corbyn's party, so you're supposed to be so right on that lots of people don't want to vote for you. And you're just doing it wrong, and it's confusing. And to be clear, the problem here isn't that people think that the Labour leadership itself is anti-Semitic. The problem is that the Labour leadership seems to say and perhaps think a lot of things that makes people who are anti-Semitic think, this is the party for me. And the problem Labour has is that these people just won't shut up. They come at them again and again. They're all over social media going, you know, this is a smear by your enemies. And the Corbynites are going, yes, it is. And then these people are going, who are the Jews? And the Corbyn people are going, oh, no, they're not. You're not Jeremy Corbyn supporters. And they're going, well, yes, we are. We paid £3 and we've got a badge. And Corbyn's going, oh, God, this is never going to end. It's such a struggle. And then Ken Livingstone pops up and goes, you know who else had a struggle? And, and on it goes forever and perhaps always will.
Part of it was about the fact that he was sort of, he liked things on Facebook. And I don't think that we should judge people on what they like on Facebook, because according to Facebook, my favourite band is Keane.
I think the social media element is definitely, I think it's a problem for all the political parties, because I think social media forces them to sort of face up to how unpleasant quite a lot of their supporters might be, you know. And normally the thing about social media is those people, you know, they used to stay at home and just shout obscenities at the television. They were people with no friends, and deservedly so. And now, but now they have a platform via social media. And of course, when the Labour Party did its special offer for membership, they forgot to put a question on the registration form that said, "Are you a hate-filled bigot?" which, I mean, to be fair, The Tories don't ask their supporters that question either. Perhaps they already know the answer. I don't know.
Do you think
and,
there should
and
be a...
For UKIP, of course, it's a rhetorical question.
How is it to be rooted out, then, the anti-Semitism with Labour? I mean, is there a sort of price structure thing? Do you think racists should pay a different membership rate or something? What's... what? Is there a practical solution?
Perhaps they could, like, round them all up and force them to live in the same place, wearing some kind of badge.
Yeah, this... don't boo pragmatism.
I'm Jewish. I get quite a lot of anti-Semitic abuse on social media, particularly on Facebook. Not all of it is mad. It's most upsetting when it's not mad. But the maddest I ever had was somebody who, because of my profile picture, I used to be wearing a green shirt. There's this wide body of people who thought that green shirt was me from my time in the IDF. And this woman once tweeted me one afternoon and said, "I see you're in the IDF." And I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" And she says, "Tell me where you served in the IDF." And I said, "Is this about the shirt?" And she said, "Yes, tell me about your time in the IDF." And I said, "It's from Top Man." Because it was. And she said, "Well, that's immaterial. Tell me about your time in the IDF." And I said, "I'm a gossip journalist from Edinburgh." And she said, "But still, tell me about your time in the IDF." And I was like, "Do you think I was a gossip journalist from Edinburgh before or after I was in the IDF?" And she said, "That doesn't really matter to me. Just, I don't know why you're being so evasive." And seriously, this went on and on and on. And eventually, lots of other people decided this was very amusing and so joined in, pretending that they knew the details of my time in the IDF, so as to wind up the crazy trolls, saying, "Oh, Hugo served in this unit and, you know, sort of like won a medal in the Lebanon." And eventually I got annoyed and said, "Look, for God's sake, can people stop pretending I'm some kind of secret agent?" At which point the Israeli embassy tweeted me with a smiley face saying, "Come on in, Hugo, we just want to talk." And that was my life on social media.
But to be fair, Hugo, and there is a serious point here, is that we all know that Top Man is part of a Zionist plot.
Yeah, Top
that's,
Man.
That's... I reckon there's going to be a lot of virtue signalling by the parties now. I think for show they're going to start throwing out a lot of members. You know, there'll be a lot of high moral ground. I mean, they'll accept their votes at the election. They're not that principled, but I think they'll...
I mean, in fairness, out of 75 complaints, they have kicked out a grand total of 2. So I'm not sure they'll throw out that many members.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it'll accelerate to 3 or 4 quite fast.
Some of it is bonkers, isn't it? Then when he went to spend Passover with the Jewish Labour people, then other people went mad. Oh, now he's gone and met Jews that... like him. That's not the sort. You're supposed to spend Passover with Jews that hate you. Is that a Jewish tradition?
Sort of is, yeah.
We're Christians, should be the same. Why don't we do it with Christmas, don't we? Oh, Jesus, I've got to spend bloody Christmas with him.
What, Jesus?
But what do you... Exactly. I mean, it's an interesting sort of philosophical dilemma, isn't it? What do you do when you are being supported by people you despise? I remember Simon Hoggart telling me this story about the Labour MP, Bob Marshall-Andrews. You know, he's out canvassing, rings the doorbell. This bloke opens the door, says, "Oh, Bob, yeah, you're Labour, I'm going to vote for you because I hate this Conservative guy because they're letting so many bloody foreigners in the country, aren't they? So you've got my vote." And Bob Marshall-Andrews said, "No, I forbid you from voting for me." And the guy went, "No, I'm going to vote for you lot because you don't..." He said, no, I forbid you from vote for me." And this huge fight started.
This is the Labour Party's ongoing problems with anti-Semitism. To fill you in on the history, Abraham married a woman called Sarah and she begat Isaac. Then a little while later came the 1981 Labour Party conference and the rest you know. This week there's been a disciplinary tribunal looking into the case of Mark Wadsworth, a Labour activist accused of anti-Semitism. We don't know how these tribunals work. Presumably they get you in and ask you how anti-Semitic you are on a scale of 1 to 10. Len McCluskey waded in because that's what you want in an anti-Semitism debate, an intervention from a man who looks as if he's permanently sweating off a hot pork lunch. Some Labour supporters say that anti-Semitism has been unfairly weaponised to attack Corbyn, in the same way that the Windrush generation, not having a plan for Brexit, allowing a crisis to develop in the NHS, failing to sort out housing, underfunding schools, missing your own immigration targets and cocking up a general election, have been unfairly weaponised to attack Theresa May. 2 points to Hugo. Susie, who is the bank that liked to say yes, but now says, "We regret to inform our customers that this service is currently unavailable"? We apologise for any inconvenience. If you require any further information, call the number below. We hope to have things up and running again soon. Thank you for your patience.
This is the TSB story. Basically, last Friday, they took online banking offline over the weekend while they updated their online platform. And then come Sunday, the new system was meant to be up and running, and basically people just couldn't log in. They couldn't log into any of their online banking. Then finally they managed to log in, and they weren't in their own account. They were in other people's account. They could see other people's balance. And in some cases, they were credited with thousands of pounds. And a guy called Matthew Neal said he checked his account on Sunday morning to check how much he'd spent at the pub the night before and found that his account had been credited with 35 grand. And I felt more sorry for the guy whose 35 grand that was, who was doing the same thing and just thought, how much were those rounds? That is... And people are really furious about it. One lady was going, I logged in and my mortgage has completely disappeared, which I thought was the stupidest complaint I have ever heard. And it seems to have hit, like, smaller businesses more. An owner of Mentor Lock and Safe Company, Lee McDonald, who played Zamo in Grange Hill in the 80s, told the BBC he's had an absolute nightmare. And I thought, yeah, mate, if the last credit on your CV was Grange Hill, you have had an absolute nightmare. And then today, TSB said they were bringing in their IT specialists to deal with it. I thought, well, who's been dealing with it before? But, oh, no, we're sorry, we had Pam from HR and Jimmy from the photocopier room, and then Howard popped in from Halifax. Like...
You wouldn't use to check your account as regularly as you can now. Before online banking existed, you know, weeks could go past yeah. without you knowing that you had no money left in order, that you had sort of loads of money. Now
I hate it when the, you know, when you'd go and, I don't know if you've ever had this, Miles, but when you try and get money out and it says no. I don't know, but sometimes it's like no, and then it's like, would you like an advice slip? Like, what's it going to say? Ring your dad.
I'm still fascinated by the way Zamo from Grange Hill runs a lock and safe company and is complaining that he's got nowhere to keep his money.
And they shut all the branches down, and then you have to go to one about 4 miles away, and then that gets shut down, and bit by bit, then you find you've got to go to Guernsey or something. I mean, you have to ring, and they just say, well, just pop into the branch. Then shut all the branches! I can't just pop into the branch. Then... if you make a payment that's at all odd, they ring you. So in the middle of the day, you'd go, well, oh, hang on, hello, it's the bank. What? No, before I can talk to you, you just need to answer some security questions. But you've rung me. I didn't ask you to ring. You can't ring me. If you don't think it's me, ring the person you think is me. You can't do that. The security question, it'll be something like, just so that I know that you are the account holder, Mr. Steele. Just a simple question. In 1998, you bought summit. How soft was it? I hate them. I hate them. I hope all their money's gone.
I was talking to some mates who work in IT, and they explained to me that this upgrade that the TSB did uses sort of state-of-the-art technology, and apparently this technology has a tendency to bundle up the money from all the accounts and put it on a horse. Yeah. And it's all been covered up, you know. You won't hear that on Newsnight.
What always annoys me when you call the bank is they're always having an unusually high volume of calls. You think you can't always be having an unusually high volume of calls.
Both of our staff are shocked by the number of people ringing.
We're doing all we can to answer your call.
Yeah.
What is one thing you haven't tried? Picking up the phone. Give that. We've sat on it. We've smeared Parmesan cheese on it. We've spat at it. We've told it poems. It keeps ringing. I hate them. And then if you go abroad now, which isn't that unusual, they block it, don't they? They block... That happens about once every fifth time. They just...
Because
then,
it's out of character. If you make a purchase that is, you know, they deem is untypical, you know, so if you, you know, if you just like, decide to do something impetuous...
Well, they're like, we noticed you've bought a fridge. You haven't done that for 10 years.
Yeah. We just presumed that was an imposter who got hold of your
credit
card.
If someone stole your credit card and just kept using it to buy fridges or whatever, well, it's what he does.
I got a phone call from my bank when I was in New York saying, "Where are you?" And I was like, "I'm in New York." And they were like, "Well, why didn't you tell us?" I was like, "I didn't know I had to." I told my mum. Do I have to? You know as well. Just pop into the local bar.
Did they go, "We've been worried sick"?
When you landed, what's the accommodation like?
Yes, give us two rings when you get home. This is the catastrophic failure of TSB's new online banking service. Hang on, there's a problem that's not been noticed here.
Well, luckily you've covered it up really well. You make a great airline pilot. Should that light be flashing? Wait a second.
Well, good news, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be landing sooner than hoped. This is the catastrophic failure of TSB's new online banking service. For 6 days, some customers were unable to stare at their on-screen balance, wondering when they took out a direct debit to English Heritage and what kind of people they imagined they were when they did so. A number of companies were left paralysed as a result, including one belonging to former Grainshill star Lee MacDonald, whose business making animated forks and sausages had already been going through a lean 30 years. This isn't the first crisis to hit the banking industry in recent times. In 2008, RBS received a £58 billion bailout, and recently emerged the horse in the Lloyds advert was actually just two of the McGann brothers in a costume. Anyway, I'm just glad I keep my money under the bed and that the bed is in Panama. 2 points to Susan. And at the end of round one, the scores are Mark and Susie... Oh, no, I've written them... Oh, God. And at the end of round one, the scores are Mark and Susie have 4, but Andy and Hugo have 5.
Miles, I think he's going to get angry again.
Did that happen?
What?
How have they got five?
Seriously, are you seriously going to worry about the scoring on this?
Yeah, we are. We've both got a chip on our shoulder, that's why.
Yeah, OK, well...
After the edit, none of it makes any sense anyway.
No, it doesn't.
Fine.
Jennifer Lopez would have been left trouble today.
There weren't any tea bags, though. It's just been...
You know, they brought him a whole wooden box, didn't they? There wasn't.
Well, eventually...
Oh, yeah. A couple of people had to be pinned against the walls, didn't they? And you're grabbing hold of people's lapels. Well, pockets.
Can I just remind you... Can I just now remind you that I self-identify as a tall person?
We start round two with a sign spotted in an Australian supermarket.
Please sample our free country. Fresh from the farm to you, anus beef sausages. Please sample our free country, fresh from the farm to you, anus beef sausages.
Our thanks to everybody who sent that in. Andy, who's using a class action to get some more class action?
This is the story of students suing universities for some lectures that they didn't receive. And this is what happens when you turn education into a business. Because when you charge students upwards of £9,000, quite understandably, they view themselves as customers. And when customers don't receive the services they were promised, they have a tendency to sue. And there are lots of lawyers out there who are prepared to pursue a class action on behalf of the students against the suppliers, or as they insist on still calling themselves, the universities. And so they've launched a class action, and I think there's going to be more and more of this, and you know, the lawyers will spot an opportunity as well, I'm sure. Soon there'll be ads on the television with men saying, "Had a rubbish education and it wasn't your fault." There'll be a lot of that, I think. And that's just what happens when you try and define everything in monetary terms. And I'm one of the lucky people from the one of the generations that we were actually given money to improve our minds. Things were so quaint back then, weren't they? And, you know, as an English student, we would never have countenanced suing a lecturer for not turning up to lectures, because that's what we did. to be honest, we would have had no idea whether they'd turn up or not. But the industrial action that the lecturers took was that they were very worried about their pensions, so they went on strike for 2 weeks. You may have seen some of the demonstrations where they marched down the streets chanting, what do we want? Discuss.
I think it's particularly good for the law students. Because when they graduate and go to a law firm, they've already won a case. I mean, it's like when they made Tom Daly do his sports GCSE the year that he won gold at the World Championship diving. I think that it would be good if they sort of started doing it the other way around, if tutors started suing students who didn't go to class, because that's going to be the real cash cow for the uni, isn't it?
Well, I don't know why we're speculating about this when we've got a proper academic on the panel. How many lectures have you done for your doctorate? You've done
how many operations?
Well, I did a couple just to keep me hand in.
You don't want to put your whole hand in, that's...
In a way, it's quite good that students have now got, like, leverage over the institutions in which they're learning, which they get through paying fees. In a way, you could argue that. Because I remember when I was a student, I was like one of the last years not to pay fees. I can't remember what it was, but some protest we had against the kind of the college authorities. The only thing we could do in protest was occupy the library. And they were like, that's fine. That's what it's for. Get some work done.
This is the news that over 1,000 students nationwide have joined a class action demanding compensation from their universities after 14 teaching days were lost in February and March due to strike action. Senior solicitor Shimon Goldwater said no other service provider would get away with cutting a service with no price reduction. Ah, what it is to be young and have so many illusions. We have to remember that these students have paid a lot of money for the opportunity to listen to a middle-aged man struggling to remember something he once knew about the Huguenots. Some universities are referred to as red brick, since that's what the lecturers throw at you while they're protesting on the roof. Seems that universities are now filled with an atmosphere of hostility and self-interest. We had that in my day, but I thought it was just the effect that I had on people. 2 points to Andy. Hugo, have a listen to this. Hugo, who's united in a divided country?
Leeds United. They're going on a tour of Burma, even though there's a kind of big military crackdown in Burma, and people think it's a bit dodgy. And I'm wary of discussing this, because it's about a sort of strange culture I can't pretend to understand, because I've only been to Leeds once, and I don't really know... I don't really know very much about football. But I do know a bit about Burma. It's sort of ruled by this brutal military dictatorship that's been getting slightly better and then got a lot worse. And Leeds is going on a tour there, and human rights groups are saying that the junta only want them there because they want to kind of whitewash their reputation, because particularly after the sort of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya, they want to show that Burma is a safe place. And they're going to show it's a safe place by filling it up with English football fans. It shows just how far away and out of touch they are.
You know Captain Oates from the South Pole? He was from Leeds. Because I always thought they were sort of noble, dignified, you know, and I'm going out, I may not be back for some time, I'm doing the honest, decent, dignified English thing. And it makes much more sense when you know he's from Leeds, doesn't it? Because you know he was going, it's not cold out there, I'm going out for a walk. What's the matter with you? It's really warm out here, I'm taking shirt off, I am.
But that's what worries me about, you know, in Burma, that you've got a country torn apart by genocide and ethnic cleansing, and there are going to be a few Leeds fans, aren't they, walking around going, call this internecine conflict. In Pontefract, this is handbags.
Yeah. All right, Hong Sung whatnot, whatever you call yourself, come over here.
The president of the Myanmar Football Association said that part of the reason they wanted them to go is because Asia is Premier League obsessed, which would have made more sense if Leeds weren't in the championship. So they're just going to get there and be like, ah, It's not quite as good football as we like.
This is the news that Leeds United Football Club are to tour Myanmar, despite the country's ongoing military crackdown and continued human rights abuses. Amnesty International have said if the tour does go ahead, the club should use its leverage to call for an end to the crackdown, which, of course, will probably work. I'm sure we all remember that time when West Bromwich Albion ended apartheid. Amnesty say that sporting events are often used as a PR stunt to distract attention from a country's appalling human rights record. Wondering what we're using crufts to hush up. But who can forget the inspirational words of Aung San Suu Kyi? The real prison is fear, and the only real freedom is freedom from fear. We hate Man U, and we hate Man U. We hate Man U, and we hate Man U. We are the Man U haters. 2 points to Hugo. Mark, which roundabout is now a lady garden?
Say that again.
Which round... Mark, which roundabout is now a lady garden?
This is Radio 4. This is Channel 5.
Just unpack it for us, you know. Have a route around, see what you can find.
Well, I believe this refers to the garden on which there is a statue of Millicent Fawcett, who was the founder of the suffragette movement, in that she was the first person to publicly raise a petition for women to have the vote in 1866, not long after the Reform Act of 1861. Am I right, Hugo?
5 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, any facts, do check with Hugo.
I was just doing the maths. I have no idea.
You know, and as such, quite rightly, she has been afforded a statue.
And do you know who the artist is?
Oh, for God. Van Gogh, I've no idea.
Gillian Waring, was it?
That's right, that's absolutely
you sensible. See, if it's statues, you check with me.
I mean, it's not just the first statue of a woman in Parliament Square, it's the first statue made by a woman in Parliament Square as well.
There's 11 historical men and one woman, which is great because it sort of represents every boardroom in the country. So it's ideal in many ways. Theresa May told the crowd that if it wasn't for the work of Fawcett, that there would be no woman in Parliament, which probably wasn't the best example, because what she was basically saying is, if it wasn't for her, you wouldn't be stuck with this.
It's supposed to be a statue of a feminist icon, and she appears to be about to fold up a tea towel.
It's a banner, in fact, which says...
But it's a very small banner. It is a banner you do
hands.
The... banner you do the dishes with. It's not got a poles at each end. It's not a... What I'm saying is...
Can't believe you're mansplaining her banner to her. you don't want her to be a suffragette like that, love.
I thought it could have been more dynamic, you know. Obviously, the statues that I've made are more... there's more movement in them, you know.
That's not a statue.
This is the unveiling of a statue in Parliament Square commemorating leading women's suffrage campaigner Millicent Fawcett. Theresa May said, I would not be standing here today as Prime Minister without Millicent Fawcett. Way to take the shine off somebody's big day. It's the only statue of a woman in Parliament Square, but it's not the only one on the parliamentary estate. There's a statue of Margaret Thatcher in the members' lobby and some blue tack squashed into the shape of some breasts in the office of Sir Nicholas Soames. We all love the statues on Parliament Square, all of them. Gandhi, David Lloyd George, Mandela, John Noakes, Daddy Derek Underwood, Richard Madeley, Dave Rowntree from Blur, former Transport Secretary Stephen Byers, the murderer Dennis Nielsen, both Mike Reeds, Jack the Hat McVitie, and Simon Bates, all the greats. 2 points to Mark. Susie, have a listen to this. Susie, who went from having a Barney to going to Bali?
Basically what happened is a 12-year-old boy in Australia had a row with his mum, then stole the family credit card, took a flight from Sydney to Perth, then from Perth to Bali, checked into a 4-star hotel, hired a motorbike, drank beer on the beach, and then got caught by the authorities. And fair play to him for doing it all by himself. Like, sometimes I have trouble booking an Uber. The best thing about it is that he has absolutely no remorse about it. He was interviewed on Australian TV, and he went, "Oh, it was great. I wanted to go on an adventure, and I did. If I do it again, though, Mum will be really angry." And his mum started blaming the airline. She was like, "You know, the problem is he just doesn't understand the word no." But that's your problem. That's you. You can't start blaming airlines. Like, you know, my little cousin's a bit of a prick, but my auntie's not like, "Well, you know, bloody EasyJet." That's not how, not how it works, is it?
I mean, when you think of the grief that you get at security checkpoints, how on earth did he get through on his own?
Took his shoes off.
Like, in the 80s, if you travelled as a child, they'd stick a UM badge on you, if you're unaccompanied minor. Like, they would draw attention to the fact that you had no parents.
I ran away from home, but I ran away as far as Stamford Bridge, the home of Chelsea Football Club, which was about 3 minutes' walk from my house. And in those days, the Chelsea players sometimes used to train in the forecourt. So I watched them training all day long, and then I got quite hungry. In the evening, Terry Venables was driving in, and he stopped the car and he said, "Were you here this morning?" And I lied. I went, "No." And he drove on. It was also my poor mum's. It was the day she was sitting a driving test as well. So I, I messed up the day a bit. But I mean, I was a bit surprised they were so slow to work it out.
I don't think they were looking that hard.
And then it came, that crushing moment, the knock at the door, but they went and they opened the door. "Oh, no, a policeman on the front step. I'm afraid we've found him, Mrs. Hamilton." Have you ever been run away, Hugo?
No, I never ran away from home, but I didn't have to because my home wasn't in Australia.
Oh.
The day before Good Friday of this year, I was driving along early in the morning when Thought for the Day comes on. And this was... And I do love Thought for the Day.
And you thought, "I should emigrate. This is unbearable."
We all know the way they just do whatever they had were doing the previous day, they just shovel Jesus into it, don't they? "Last night, I was watching my favourite episode of Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmare. Once again, some poor hapless restaurateur found himself on the wrong end of Mr. Ramsay's somewhat ribald invective, and... I began to think to myself, isn't this a little bit like Jesus? Because Jesus went out for supper one night, and that turned into a bit of a nightmare. Good morning." But this was a real one, right? He says, "Many Australians of my acquaintance are rather perturbed at the disturbing stories that have emerged about the Australian cricket team, and they feel very much that the miscreants have somewhat let down their team, in much the same way that Jesus on Good Friday felt let down by his team." It was a real one.
This is the tale of a 12-year-old Australian boy who, following an argument with his parents, flew unaccompanied to Bali and stayed for 4 days in a top hotel, running up a $6,000 debt on his parents' credit card. You have to remember, though, this child was Australian, and so even by the age of 11 would already have the appearance of a weather-beaten, sunburnt racist. The boy's mother said he doesn't like hearing the word no, unless it's followed by the words, "Problem at all, sir. Enjoy your stay in Bali." I suppose some people's kids are more independently minded than others. I've been leaving brochures for Bali on our kitchen table all week. Not a sniff. The parents have now grounded the boy, but if they really wanted to punish him, they could simply have rung up the Indonesian authorities and accused him of speaking out against the president. 2 points to Susie. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they would like to share? Andy?
This is from Peter Taylor of Parkstone in Poole, and it's from a recent school newsletter, and it concerns e-safety. It says, "Several concerns have been raised about the game Roblox. Children have been accepting friend requests from strangers, resulting in inappropriate message content being seen by young children. Worryingly, reports are indicating there are also naked characters walking around and that they are doing adult things. Parents are being asked to stop playing immediately."
Hugo. This is sent in by Richard and Kate Harris, and they saw it on a recent visit to Singapore. And it's a no-smoking sign with the picture, and it says, no smoking within 15 feet of anywhere.
Mark.
This is from Toby Wilson of Worthing. This is a customer review of some binoculars on the Argos website. Really good value for money and impressive when giving as a present. Only drawback was it's no good over distances.
Susie.
This was seen by Ali Connie Jones, who saw this typo on a bookings.com hotel review. Great room, good choice, and quality foof.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score. Mark and Susie have 8, but this week's winners are Andy and Hugo with 9. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from the Eastbourne Herald opinion page.
We could promote our coastal gem more effectively. Helpful information could include some facts about the park, maps of the area, footpaths for walkers, wildlife in the area, parking arrangements, buses, local camping sites, tide times, and warnings about the ever-present danger of cliff falls and local eateries.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Hugo Rifkin, Mark Steele and Susie Ruffle. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Diana Speed. The chair's script was written by Max Davis, James Kettle and Daniel Ward, with additional material by Heidi Regan and Mike Shepherd. The producer was Joe Nunnery, and it was a BBC Studios production.